Welcome. It's good to see each one of you. Thank you for coming and engaging with us in a conversation about the Charter of Values in La Belle Provence. I had the lovely good fortune of living in Quebec, in Montreal, in 1968. So I had come from the riots on the west side of Chicago to the riots across the street in Parc La Fontaine. And I developed an enormous affection for Montreal and for a part of Canada, the first part of Canada that I got to know, that at the time I said had an actual culture, having grown up here. And us Norwegians had a culture, but it was pretty small by comparison. I want to say just a little bit as a matter of background to this, and Jerome is going to walk into the charter itself and reflect on what's at work here. I remember my first walk into Notre Dame Cathedral in Montreal, this extraordinary building, and seeing the very large paintings on the walls of the Passion and Death of Jesus Christ, of the life of the Virgin, and noticing to my very Protestant and very Lutheran eyes, that the Holy Virgin Mary was always twice as large as Jesus Christ was. In fact, in that extraordinary image of the deposition, when the body of Christ is taken down off the cross and laid across the lap of Mary, he is a not very large 13-year-old. It was so striking to me. And I remember going to a party with good, well, not good friends of mine, but with a friend of mine who was trying to teach me French. Well, I taught him English. Needless to say, I was a much better teacher than he was. He learned English. And that evening, to a group of people from both France, because there were a number of people from France there as well as Quebec, I raised this. I said, look what I see here. What's this about? And all of them were shocked, having never noticed. So it said something to me. It gave me a little inkling into, I think, part of the deep structure of the Quebecois. It also says something about the place of women, of course. And if you place that in the context of Quebec Catholicism, I think it needs to be borne in mind when we think about what some of the current struggles are in Quebec. Quebec Catholicism, as no doubt some of you know, perhaps better than I, is peculiar. Or was peculiar. This was highlighted for me by a colleague at the National Museum in Ottawa who was a specialist on folk tradition in Quebec and had written a massive volume on wayside crosses in Quebec. This is many years ago now, but I remember him saying to me when we were talking about some of these matters that in his view, in Quebec, this is his quote, not mine, I assure you, that the Jesus Christ in the New Testament did not arrive in Quebec until 1960. Prior to that, it was the God of judgment of the Old Testament. He painted this picture in very stark terms. Now, in my own work on religion in Canada, a couple things have become clear to me. One is that Quebec is one of the last places in the Catholic world where Jansenism, a particular movement in Catholicism in Europe, survived. It survived a few hundred years after it had survived anywhere else, after it had actually been cast out, formally cast out of the Catholic tradition. Jansen, we commonly say that Jansenism was a kind of Catholic Calvinism. My Calvinist friends would be outraged at that, of course. But what's meant by it is that it was a kind of Catholicism that was so deeply riveted on fear and judgment. When you take that into account in a society which didn't really experience the French Revolution, you can clean this up, until 1960. You know, the French Revolution didn't get to Quebec until 1960. So you have a kind of les anciens regime there, where the bishop and le chef are hand in glove with each other until Charbonneau came along. It is a very, very curious situation in the North American context, and perhaps even in Europe. You have as most of you know, I suppose, it wasn't really till 1960 that in Quebec you could study anything other than medicine, law, and the priesthood. You couldn't get a business degree, you couldn't study architecture. You know, I mean, it's a really unusual place, and I thought that was great. I really wish they'd have hung on to it myself. That's the anthropologist in me. But they didn't. And, of course, they entered the modern world in an extraordinarily rapid way. 1960, the birth rate in Quebec was higher than any place else, certainly in North America, substantially higher. People were going to church in substantially larger numbers. And in one decade, it became the most secular place in North America. Birth rate, as well as church attendance and church support. But it, of course, has had a legacy of these very large religious institutions. Remarkable institutions in so many ways. And particularly noteworthy, such a remarkable role that women have played in Quebec. There is a sense in which, I think I would argue, that Quebec is, it's the only society I know, the only civil society I know, which was actually founded by women. It was founded by the great religious women who came from France in order to get a little bit of distance from the bishops and be able to do their own work. People like Marguerite Bourgeois founded the first school in Canada. Remarkable human being. And Marie de l'Incarnation and the local homegrown Marguerite Youville. Remarkable group of people that set up the civil structures of Quebec, of course, within this deep religious framework. And then it was like it ended unbelievably fast. So one wonders why. So I'm just going to suggest a couple little things. One is that sort of traditional cultural making in Quebec within that particular kind of Catholicism ended up becoming pretty brittle once it actually has to engage the modern world. Before that, I think it's another story. But once it has to, it's forced to engage the modern world, it becomes very brittle. And, of course, you don't have to hit things that are brittle with a very large hammer for them to completely shatter. And shatter it did. But it is endlessly curious to me to see, this is certainly my perspective, to see the way in which the culture you inherit and the culture you also reject remains so deeply within you in so many new ways. It seems to me that is at work in part of what we see here. One just final larger issue to put on the table before Jerome walks us into this. I've been spending some time in Turkey in the last few years, and Turkey, of course, under Kemal Atatürk, had a form of laïcité, of this French notion of the relationship of state and church that we see being worked on or worked through in Quebec. A few things of note. In the period that Atatürk and the government that flowed from him was in charge up to about 10, 11 years ago, you also could not appear in public with any kind of religious garment on. When I first went there in 1998, my two colleagues who I brought on that research trip, who were both Orthodox monks, we stopped at the border with Turkey. We had to stop at the border with Turkey. And they needed to disrobe, take off their Orthodox garments. Now, I admit, they put on black slacks, black shirt, black trench coat. It looked pretty Orthodox to me, but formally it would pass. And that was true, of course, across the board, much more important, really, for Muslims than for Christians, I suspect, because there were so few Christians left in Turkey. It was also the case that to become part of the army in Turkey, you had to sign an oath of committing yourself and your family to a kind of formal atheism, like the Soviet Union or China. That if you were found near a religious building in a religious posture or with any book, not just the Quran, but the work of Said Nursi or somebody else, you were immediately thrown in the brig for 8 years, then stripped of your rank and your pension and tossed into the street. It was pretty firm. Pretty firm. So I've met a number of Turks whose families experienced that. So you could not go to university or work in the public service if you had hijab on. Big thing was made of that in 1999. It had been present before. So now there is a new government. 10 years now. That government has changed a number of things. When I was in Konya at the university I was in the Faculty of Theology, where there are 2,000 students, 85% of them are women. Of that, you can count on one hand the ones that do not have hijab on. We end up with this kind of reaction, this side to that side. It's a sense that social policy is kind of like a drunk reeling from one side to the other in these periods until we create a more sober kind of environment, which is one of the great advantages, of course, of public discussion. A colleague of mine who is there, who has studied Hebrew, Jewish studies, is a professor there, and to my surprise, she did not wear hijab. The only one of two professors that does not, except for the men. For some reason, it's good enough for the women, but not for the men. I've never figured that one out. You know, if niqab is good enough for women, why not for men? In any case, she has said to me that she's very pious, that during the period, during the Atatürk period, she always wore hijab because of her piety. In the period now, when religion has become much more legitimate in the public square, in her sense, the religious life also has taken on a new political character. It has taken on some of the identity politics of that wonderful country, Turkey. So for her, as a deep believing person, she felt it incumbent to take off the hijab. Do you understand? To not identify herself with what she would see as an identity politics issue instead of a deep pious issue. So this kind of swinging from side to side is so common in these periods of great cultural and social change. And Quebec has an intellectual legacy that it's working out here. It is trying to distance itself even further, it seems to me, from images, which many of the young wouldn't remember anymore, I don't suppose, but images of all those wonderful nuns all wearing hijab. Hijab, you know, is a Christian contribution to Islam, as I like to point out to my Muslim friends. You should be grateful to us. We gave you hijab. So, I'm delighted Jerome is taking a close look at this document and is going to unwrap it for us.
Hey, David. I don't have the gift of storytelling that David does, nor am I really used to making my point through storytelling. And in order to actually fit in the time I want to fit this in, and so we can, may actually speak with each other afterwards, I've limited myself to words on pages. I think that if we want to really understand this charter, and specifically this part of the charter, we have to pay attention to the very larger context in which it inscribes itself. So we have to go beyond the explicit references that the charter itself makes, or that politicians are making in Quebec. And it'd be great to have a look at the whole history of laïcité or secularism in Quebec and explain the differences between secularism and laïcité as pertaining to, you know, Protestantism and Catholicism on the other hand. And I had planned to do that and to bring in the Bouchard-Taylor report on reasonable accommodations, which does a great job of explaining what laïcité and interculturalism mean in Quebec, and also have presents quite an attack on multiculturalism as coming from English Canada. But we're only here for an hour and not for three. So instead, I thought I'd do what no one seems to be doing, which is actually read the thing. Everybody's speaking about this on the radio. On the radio, ceaselessly, you have experts, non-experts. No one is speaking about the charter. Manifestos and articles and opinion pieces are being published by very, very smart people. No one seems to have read the thing. So what is the charter? It's basically the 5 points you find in the English document here on page 2. Very slowly moving towards it here. So these 5 points here, which then take us back to this central piece, which is, this is what's allowed and what's not allowed.
Go back to the 5 points.
I'm sorry?
We'll go back to the 5 points.
Absolutely.
So people can see them a little bit longer.
So I'll show you a few bits here while I'm speaking. Maybe try to actually even zoom in a little bit, if my mouse will let me do it. What happens here on the bottom, anyway?
Well, there's this small brochure, which is meant to be printable and foldable, so that if you want to distribute it, I suppose, you could do that. There's also a long brochure, which is about 10 pages, which explains a bit more. Then you have also a 20-page document, an orientation document, that explains all the underlying reasons and gives a lot more detail and a lot more guidance to those who will be tasked with applying this charter. So that's what I did. I read those documents as a philosopher and as a political, I don't know, a student of politics. I still don't like to use the word science. So what I want to do is basically to describe the charter itself and what I call an ideological operation that takes place in this charter. It revolves around three main values. That's why I call it an ideological operation. Ideology is to bring values and ideas together and to hierarchize them and to make connections between them to lead us towards a specific goal. This is what the charter does with regard to the ideas of democracy, equality, specifically between women and men, and democracy. This charter was meant to be, in the beginning, a charter of laïcité, or secularism. Its evolution, the way it was built, led instead to a focus on values that are said to be, you know, our common values, the common values of Quebecers. In other words, the value of secularism on its own proved to not be sufficient to the ends that the government was pursuing. So we found the first puzzling to me, element of the charter. There's only three main values that are really presented in it. So these are the Quebec values. In the order given in the documents, the first is the primacy of French. And even that value is not really discussed. It's affirmed, and then we move on from there. The second value is state secularism, so it's separating religions from the state, establishing the neutrality of the state towards religion, and ensuring equality between citizens, be they women or men. This is citoyenne et citoyen. So equality between citizens in terms of religious beliefs and moral and philosophical convictions as well. And the third value, which is already hinted at in this difficult to translate use of citoyenne et citoyen, is the equality between men and women that follows a long struggle for the rights of women that now extends to all women beyond origins and beliefs, and not only to the women who belong to those who call themselves us, those who call themselves Quebecers. The underlying test here is that women who have arrived in Quebec through immigration, women who belong to non-Christian faiths, are not yet free. Hence the need for a charter. Many who have commented on the charter have already pointed out that the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Quebec has its own charter. It adopted this charter 6 years before Canada did. This charter already recognizes gender equality. So in effect, talking about this value in the context of this charter adds absolutely nothing to the law. It's already illegal to discriminate on the grounds of gender in Quebec. A chronology is presented in the documents that begins in 1964 when the Department of Education was first created, and so when education was taken away from the religious organizations and taken on by the state, up until 2008 when this equality between men and women was placed in the Quebec Charter of Rights. You also have references to different laws that led to the equality of women around marriage, around contraception, homosexuality, around abortion. And they also add in there, why not, the deconfessionalization of school boards, which used to be Catholic and Protestant up until 97. So I went to public school, but under a Catholic school board. The same chronology is presented in detail in the orientation document with what this means for everyone. But the story we find in these documents that explain and justify the charter is the story of the equality between men and women in Quebec. The Catholic Church was responsible for inequality. Now this is over. Quebecois are equal to the Quebecois. Now it is other religions that are responsible for the continuing inequality of women. What we have with this document is an interesting and daring ideological operation. So a re-hierarchization, a reorganization of the main values to be pursued by the Quebec government through this reinterpretation of its own history, of the history of the state and of the society it serves. So the second value has to do with secularism, broadly understood, or state neutrality towards religions. The state must be neutral, both in its institutions and in its representatives. So it's not enough that the state itself not have any religious goals. Those who act on behalf of the state, any public servant whatsoever, and this includes people who work in state-sponsored daycares, and there are a lot of them in Quebec, whoever represents the state may currently, before the charter, show their religious beliefs at work. It's permitted. There's no law. But after the charter, they will need to display religious neutrality both in their behavior and in their appearance. Just as they must already display political neutrality. They can't promote one party over another. In the same way, you can't promote a religion over another. Here as elsewhere, religious belief is brought on the same level as political belief, on the same level as moral and philosophical conviction, or indeed at the same level as any other facet of a person's identity, which may not be grounds for discrimination, and the state is only worried with identities in as much as it cannot discriminate among them. To explain one particular point about what is a reasonable accommodation, for instance, the example of seeing eye dogs is used. And so everything is on the same level. There exists one exception in terms of the neutrality of institutions, because the historical heritage of Quebec must be preserved. And so the crucifix that is still now in the National Assembly, so in the Quebec Parliament, the cross on top of Mont-Royal, both of them will be kept in place. Also, school names, town names, there's a lot of saints in Quebec. Many of them were not saints, actually. But there's a lot of saints in Quebec. And these will not be changed. One school apparently had changed its name some years ago for that reason. And the document also precises that despite its role in the oppression of women, the Catholic religion has also played a fundamental role in Quebec history and is part of its heritage. And so they write in the longer brochure, this is my approximate translation, rich with its history, Quebec is proud of its heritage, which explains where we come from and what we are today. It's important to transmit it to the young generations and to any person coming from elsewhere, so that they may, in their turn, enrich themselves with this heritage. The rationale then extends to the need to protect the cultural and historical heritage of Quebec, even as the value of secularism, laicity, and neutrality are upheld. The second puzzling aspect to me is the context out of which the Charter emerged. It's the product of the Department for Democratic Institutions. The federal government has a department for a ministry for democratic reform, right? It's seen as a good thing these days to have a ministry that looks into what we're not going to change. So both secularism and equality are framed implicitly by a larger reference to democracy. But democracy itself is mostly absent from the documents as a main focus. But democracy is presented insofar as it leads to this duty of neutrality, and neutrality will then ensure independence and tolerance in government, so a government that's independent from religion and tolerant towards religions. And neutrality will also allow for the possibility for every citizen to be able to recognize herself or himself in the state. If the state does not take on a religion, does not present any kind of religious appearance, it's easier for citizens to see it as their state, as part of the same society as they are. So, secularism as neutrality is essential for democracy in this context.
since, and this is what they write in the longer document, the state takes its legitimacy from the will of the people without distinction in religion and with respect toward the belief and non-beliefs of all citizens, women and men. That's the will of the people. So Rousseau rears his head here.
Can you just repeat that?
Yeah. So the state takes its legitimacy from the will of the people without distinction in religion. So religion has no part to play in forming the will of the people. And with respect, by respecting the beliefs and non-beliefs of all citizens, be they women or men. So we find in the conclusion of the document another reference to a general will that's reasonable for all, as opposed to majority rule. So what the document says is, no matter where the majority stands on this issue, this is where the general will stands. This is what everyone, if they properly understood the situation, should want, would want. This is good for everyone, no matter where the majority votes. We have a minority government in Quebec right now. So from this duty of neutrality comes two further obligations. Anybody who works for the state must abstain from proselytizing. So this is called a duty of reserve. But also abstain from manifesting religion in the space of the state. This is what the duty of neutrality. So wearing a symbol of any, or a symbol of any kind, is actually described as passive proselytizing. So all of you who are wearing crosses here today, you're trying to convert everybody else who is in this room.
And we're not happy about it.
Oh,
neither.
So the anti-clericalism of Quebec's Quiet Revolution is threatened by this reintroduction of religious character in public institutions through these ostentatious symbols. So Quebecers, women and men, always women and men first, Quebecois and Quebecois, are said to want to live within these democratic institutions that foster cohesion. But there are no rules yet to ensure the possibility of this democracy. And this is why we have what they call challenges, tensions, imbalances, and a crisis. These are the words that we find in the charter. And the government is responding to this challenge, these tensions, this imbalance, this crisis, by putting forward rules so that Quebecers' desires are respected. The state will then be in a position to strengthen civic bonds, so that people can choose civic bonds over having religious differences that divide the collectivity. There's a very brief point I want to make, because it's actually not central, it turns out. This is not a Parti Québécois thing. This is not a sovereignist plot. In 2008, the Ministry of Immigration of Quebec, because Quebec has partial power over its own immigration, added to the form that one must fill to become a Quebec citizen, a declaration that includes Quebec values. And so when you sign that form, you declare that you want to live according to those values, you declare that you will learn French. And so these Quebec values, this whole idea of talking about Quebec values, is not a sovereignist plot. It's not an electoral plot. It's been around for a while. It's part of a deeper nationalist trend that we find in Quebec. Now, this part is what's new. So the one ideological operation that takes place in the context of this Charter of Values in 2013, I can describe as taking place in three parts. First, secularism is played side by side with equality between men and women and the primacy of French. And these values are presented as sacred alongside churches, synagogues, and mosques. Second, in accompanying orientation documents around the matter, secularism is attached to the goal of creating equality between men and women. This is why we need this charter, to create equality between men and women. And third, rules for religious accommodations without any reference to culture, to interculturalism whatsoever. And so we're only talking about religion here and not at all about problems around interculturalism or multiculturalism. So rules for religious accommodations are laid out so as to help new Quebecers integrate into the workforce, and to understand Quebec society, and to help, in the end, all Quebecers to live together and recognize themselves in those who give and receive public services. So these rules focus on the outward appearance of persons as pertains to the need for the state to manifest, to show its secular character and its dealings for citizens, and so for the state to act as a gathering point for all Quebecers to gather cohesively as a nation. And so this ideological operation is set in the context of a need to assemble, to gather, se rassembler, around our common values. Welcoming immigrants is said to be only possible against this previous gathering. Those who gather are those who welcome and include others. Others are invited to join them, following the already agreed upon social contract. Also, whereas the word society is used most often to speak of the body that's going to welcome and integrate, there's equivocity between the concepts of collectivity, society, and nation. So all these operations that make up the Charter are meant to foster the conditions necessary for a cohesive nation to be born through the institutions of the state, as well as for the common good of the Quebec society, which is said to be increasingly multi-ethnic, by allowing this collectivity to gather around a neutral state, around a specific cultural and linguistic heritage that's available to all, that all must take on as their own. So that's the point of the Charter. All who come to Quebec must join the collectivity that's already gathering as a nation and take on as their own the cultural and linguistic heritage. Failing that, irreconcilable and probably violent divisions can only occur. So now that we know what the Charter is, because you know, I don't know what I'm talking about, we hope that we can have a bit of a conversation about this, where we can act more as resources than as speakers. So we welcome your questions, your comments.
Yeah, what do you hear?
Detail things, but
what do you want to tease up and think about a little bit?
Since you're here.
Okay, thank you. First, thank you for clarifying this charter for us. We've heard many things about it on the radio without knowing exactly what was on the underneath. I wanted first to make sure I understood one part of it. So you were saying this charter was not brought up by the Parti Québécois, who is in power actually. So it's been around for a while.
Every part but this.
Oh, but
essentially.
This.
So the what is really different with this charter is the requirement for what can and cannot be worn. But everything else is part of a larger debate and really something that all the parties in presence in Quebec seem to be supporting.
Okay. Last week or during probably 10 days ago, I came across a cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was describing Pauline Marois, the current Prime Minister of Quebec, in her car. She was driving, and she was thinking about a situation in which somebody wearing a hijab is handing out papers to another person described as a European, and telling him, "Welcome to Canada," or "Welcome to Quebec." And the cartoonist says, "Oh, this is tricky." And the cartoonist doesn't say anything else. And when I think about this cartoon, and I mean, when I analyze the situation, and when I compare or put it beside what you describe as 0G, my question is isn't it sort of a strategy for Pauline Marois, who is actually in a minority government, to say, okay, we want a Quebec where people from abroad cannot, you know, take power and be welcoming other people like us in Canada. I'm asking this because when we take what they call ostentatoire, I don't know how to translate it in English, signs that people can see and signs that people cannot see. If we take, for example, the cross, what is the limit? So if I wear a small cross that people can see, and if I wear a big cross that people can see, what is the difference? They will still say, oh, see, you cannot wear this, but they accept that. Mm-hmm. So, hello.
Do you want to address this first? Or?
I listened yesterday to an interview with Jean Dorion, the sovereignist member of the Assembly for many years, and who also founded an organization for laïcité. And one of his comments was that, because he's really changed his view about this rather dramatically, and he made the argument that you're really hinting at, that Madame Prime Minister and a small group within, he suggested, that they have tied this wagon to the possibility of garnering more of the vote in the next election from rural Quebecers. I haven't analyzed it, so I know nothing about this, really. It does raise a curious concern in me, which I'll come to in a minute. But he also said that, in his view, this was extremely short-sighted, because while it may turn out to mean something for them in this coming election, if you look at the demographics of Quebec, this is over. You know, they've got to find ways to engage pluralism in a way, he suggested, that is a bit richer than the fear that's being played out here. That was his argument about it, in any case.
As for me, just to answer that very briefly, and I'll turn to Tim, I have a hard time seeing it as an electoral plot, because every party in Quebec has said the same thing, but with regards to other things. So the Bill 101, the language law, right, the Charte de la langue française, it is a charter of the French language. It is law. It frames everything the government does. It's a constitutional document. This charter requires that anyone who immigrates to Quebec learn French, not French or English, but actually, and that they actually sign the document saying that they will learn French. And all parties have supported it, and there's no sign of anyone actually doing that. The debate is actually over whether it should be broader, to apply to more businesses, more institutions. Multiculturalism is being rejected in Quebec in favor of interculturalism, which means that you have a central culture, which is the welcoming culture, which is enriched by the diverse culture that enjoys it, and so will, of course, change over time, but maintains that reference to a past that happens to be a past that's also tied to a specific ethnic and cultural group, but is not only their own. This to be taken on by anyone. And so there seems to be a very logical broadening of scope here, from language to culture to attitudes towards religion, that are central to Quebec politics and to Quebec nationalism. And so I have a hard time believing this is merely an interim plot. This seems to be what every government in Quebec wants. Whether they're going to actually put it forward or not is a whole other question. And there's a lot to be said around identity politics and those kinds of issues, especially the fact that
this whole idea of neutrality is only possible if you understand religion in the way that's been possible as a result of secularization. And so religions that have not undergone secularization have not changed, and so cannot be confined to the private in the way that Catholicism can. Or wear symbols. I don't think the hijab is a symbol. Catholics are, well, Christians aren't required to wear crucifixes. That's not my job.
The reason I asked you to repeat that part of that you were reading out is that it seems to me it contradicts each sentence. Each of those two sentences contradict each other. And what I'm curious about is what has caused Quebec, out of basically most of the rest of North America, to throw out the concept of the separation of church and state. Because Quebec is not adhering to that principle in doing this, because they are directly interfering with religion, rather than separating it, rather than allowing religion to be something that they will not subsidize, perhaps. But at the same time, that's totally different from saying, no, we're going to make it blank.
I think what you see here is the difference between secularism, which is what you're which you're explaining, and laïcité. So if you follow the French model and the Quebec model, because it was always a religion to the Catholic Church, every believer and every citizen within one person has been essentially separated. And so there's a lot of consequences that follow from that. But I'll just say here that essentially Quebecers and really the French have never understood the separation of church and state or state and religion in the way that you expose it. The state must regulate religion. The state must be above religion.
Can I just add a little bit to this?
Sure.
I mean, just to put the edge on it. My sense has been that in France, you don't have a separation doctrine at all. You have a colonization doctrine. I mean, that's a harsh word to use.
No,
but it's because of this notion that Jerome has raised. And it only applies, in France, until recently, it has only applied to the Roman Catholic Church. Now, that's changing. That's part of what's changing here.
Sorry, but by colonization, you mean that the state is colonizing religion. The state,
must
be in charge of religion.
That's right. Has a bureaucracy to control it, to hem it in, and to keep defining it. An extraordinary example of this, when I was doing some work in France 15 years ago, that became so vivid to me. I don't know if you recall Cardinal Lefebvre, who actually became a... He was excommunicated by the Vatican because he refused to adopt the new vernacular liturgy, and he continued to ordain priests. So he was excommunicated by the Vatican. Once he was excommunicated by the Vatican, the state bureaucracies for religion in France no longer cared about him. That shows you how thorough this is. I mean, he was an old Catholic. But the old Catholics didn't count within the law. Only the Roman Catholics within that bureaucracy, which is the patrimony of the nation, and where the nation has, in some sense, I think, through the revolution and what have you, is deeply concerned to continue to relate to, but to relate to above it, not, and in that sense, to continue to draw boundaries around it. So part of what's happening here is that those boundaries are no longer just around what was the historical patrimony of the community, which the state is endeavoring to, I would argue, reduce to heritage, hem in by the notion of heritage. That is now being applied in a more pluralistic way.
So then how does one reconcile the second sentence, which says respect?
The state must respect the beliefs and non-beliefs of all citizens.
Okay. Doesn't that undermine everything that they're doing in this charter?
But the state defines what the landscape of those beliefs can be. It respects those beliefs as long as they're in your heart or your head or in your private world.
It doesn't say that.
No, but that, well, I think that's the overall gist of it, though.
I think this idea of not distinguishing between religions, on the one hand, and then respecting the beliefs, means that there's a distance that's going to be maintained between the state and any kind of belief. And what this goes back to is really something that's a lot more akin to liberalism as John Rawls has put it forward, which is essentially religion, morals, philosophy, whatever we believe in, we leave that at home. When we argue over politics, when we take part in politics, we only appeal to what is common to all of us. The rest we just leave out, which is a way to respect it, because it doesn't matter what you think, we're not going to go against it. We're going to find a consensus beyond what each of us believes at home.
Would Quebec government be willing to allow people in the public service to wear PQ buttons?
No. So I already said here that it's not allowed.
Only shirts that advertise corporations. You see, it's the new dogma.
I was interested to read this week that a former justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Claire Leroux-Dubé, has now come out in favor of the Quebec Charter. And that, of course, was very surprising to me because, of course, you'd never be able to do this as a sitting justice because, of course, these cases, the interpretation of the Quebec Charter, may very well come before the courts. And you, of course, obviously that would be biased if you said, well, I support this before it's come to the court. But what it struck me as indicating is that there is a hierarchy of values at play here. And for her, who is well known to be very much for the equality of women and men, that value trumps any so-called freedom of religion, because she, I don't know this, I'm speculating that for her, the equality of women and men is incompatible with large or ostentatious signs of religious identity, and in particular the hijab, because I think if it weren't for the hijab, we wouldn't even be talking about these things. Jews have been wearing the kippahs for years and years, crosses, but once we, and even the turban is really not a problem, but once you get into the hijab of the people, for many people, including her, she would say, that's too far. We cannot allow this. But how do we make this palatable? Well, we can't just single out Islam for criticism. We have to include everyone in the same basket. But for her, I think the hierarchy of rights puts that type of visible equality at the very top and trumps everything else. I don't know what you think.
The government has definitely been pushing this as a way to free Muslim women. The bishops of Quebec have pointed out that they might just stay at home instead of taking off the hijab, and that also we're not going to stop men from wearing beards, which in some cases is a religious...
In some cases it is,
and in others it's not.
Yeah. Yours is religious, but mine isn't.
So that's definitely a part of it, right? That there's this and there's a call from some Muslim women who have lived in Quebec for a long time, who are part of the Quebec civil society, have been active publicly, who are adamantly fighting against the hijabs to make it illegal. So there's a very strong voice both from Muslim women and from feminists against the hijab. And there's also feminist groups at the moment who are arguing against the charter and arguing for a different kind of secularism in Quebec. But that seems to be the central issue behind it, for sure.
It's a really important point, and if I can just add one thing to it. I expect that there is another register in which this is being played out. Well, I think I more than just suspect it. And that has to do with the federal government, our current federal government. Because our current federal government has been fairly clear on its notion that freedom of religion is at the top of that hierarchy. And personal rights and freedoms have to be adjusted to freedom of religion. It's been, I mean, this is a dicey issue, but I mean, as you recognize, Alan, this is an international issue as well, because freedom of religion has the ability of cutting across individual rights and freedoms and making them subservient in a particular fashion. So the whole office of religious freedom that the government initiated here a while back, also concerns coming from a number of government ministries about what I think is also a bit of a backstory to this. I don't know what you make of this, Jerome. In Quebec, there's an advanced discussion around medical-assisted suicide. There is law cases happening before us right now, about to come to the Supreme Court, around the government's curriculum around religion and ethics, which the government is insisting be taught in every single school in Quebec, no matter what its status is, including, I understand, the Jesuit college has just been given the right to appeal before the Supreme Court of Canada around this. So there is that whole juggle and dance that's going on. But I think your point about the hierarchy is really important, and certainly the judge that you mentioned, and I think most of the parties in Quebec want to place religion and freedom of religion in a subservient place to a civil value.
What would you say is at the top of that hierarchy? That would you say is French, or would it be gender, or because? With the charter, the establishment of the rule, you have to learn French if you move to Quebec. Would you say that then, again, elevates French to the top of the government's hierarchy?
I think French is at the top of the hierarchy by default. Everybody agrees on it. And so it's not contested, and it can be used for most other aims.
Those contests are over.
Right.
They ended 30 years ago.
Whereas equality between women and men, I think everybody agrees on. It might mean different things. This is where the real conflict is. And secularism, in the same way, is something that all the parties are on side with. The question here again is, what do we do with it? What does it mean specifically? This is why I like these images. It's very clear what the PQ wants to do with it. I'm still baffled as to why exactly they're doing it, other than it must be coming out of sheer conviction. Or maybe this is where the plot is. They're trying to get the federal government to intervene in Quebec's affairs, to appeal to the Supreme Court, so the Supreme Court can cast it down, and then they can be heroes and use the non-returning clause again, mm-hmm. Or to get all the federal parties, as they are now, coming out against it and speaking about Quebec. Whereas for the last couple of years, mm-hmm. federal parties have said nothing about Quebec. The Bloc isn't around, so someone has to antagonize them. But this is a very, very bad conspiracy theory. I'm basically absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I mean,
can I ask you, have you been tracking the responses in Quebec of the Roman Catholic hierarchy? I, for example, am a bit... I haven't seen anything from the hierarchy. I haven't really looked either, so... But it seems to me, if I was the Archbishop of Quebec, I would be quite incensed at the fact that that crucifix was hanging in the National Assembly in this unbelievably blasphemous way. You know, I mean, it's blasphemy from a Catholic perspective to pretend that the crucifix is simply a part of historical patrimony. So I was wondering if the hierarchs of the church are going to be marching on the National Assembly and taking it out as a way of preserving its faith dimension.
I would love to be there just to see it happen. But you have, how many bishops does it take to stay on the cross? In fact,
that's an old story, actually.
I think, in fact, following the transformation of religion, of Catholicism in Quebec, as a result of the process of laicization and secularization, the bishops are taking positions.
Yeah.
They don't take political positions, ever. They will not speak on politics. Except the bishops have come out against some aspects of the charter, really invoking common principles of social justice, no religion whatsoever. This will lead to having Muslim women stay at home instead of taking off the hijab. Also, it's not really equal because we're not outlawing beards. And so they might as well not have been Catholics. And this is why it's possible for Quebecers to have this charter, because this is what religion looks like in Quebec. People who have devoted their whole lives to it, saying nothing about it in public, only within the confines of a church. So they won't. If they do, I'll be surprised.
Yeah.
And they might, but I'll be surprised.
Okay. I understand. I appreciate the analysis of the ideological roots of Quebec's approach to civil society and to secularization. But it seems to me, from what I know of Quebec history, that there's a profoundly xenophobic dimension of Quebec nationalism, which goes back probably as far as Quebec nationalism has existed. It was very apparent in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, before the Quiet Revolution. It was present in a profound anti-Semitism. It was present in the persecution of Jehovah's Witnesses in the 40s and 50s that Frank Scott had to take de Plessy to the Supreme Court to undo. And it seems to me it was there as much in, say, Jacques Parizeau's blaming a loss of an election on the ethnics and referring to Pyrénées, the pure Francophone descendants of the Norman founders of the Quebec nation. And this strikes me as, for all the elaborate window dressing of ideology, still yet another example of that xenophobia and catering to, pandering to that xenophobia, particularly in rural Quebec. I mean, who's going to suffer as a result of this? It won't be the devout Catholic who tuck a nice little crucifix under, you know, beneath the blouse or beneath the shirt. It's going to be the visible minorities in particular. And it ends up targeting particularly women, which is a kind of bizarre
to me.
Paradox. Yeah. To liberate women, let's see if we can have their own cultures, keep them imprisoned in the home. Because we're sure not going to allow them to come out in public unless they essentially abandon what their culture requires them to wear. So there's, it seems to me that still is yet another example of that xenophobia.
I think you're bringing up a lot here, and there's so much I'd like to say, and I'm going to forget most of it. But the reference to Rousseau, the general will of the people, is really interesting. Rousseau, 18th century philosopher, because he said we have to force people to be free. And it seems that a lot of people in Quebec do not believe that Muslim women have true convictions, that they are indeed forced by men to wear the hijab. That's one question.
Yeah.
About the brilliant Bernard Landry, who was premier for a while and now is mostly someone who talks into the papers about things, has come out and to attack Charles Taylor, the philosopher who was one of the two commissioners, because Taylor has been on the streets in those protests, he's been in the front lines of the fight against the charter, and Landry has said it's disappointing from him, mostly because it's not his usual tone as a philosopher, it doesn't befit him, but also he's a direct descendant of Madeleine de Verchères, one of the great heroes of Quebec, of the Quebec nation. He's part Purlin, he should know better.
Part Purlin, yes.
But that's right. But the xenophobic aspect is actually part of the debate. And two big manifestos have been published by intellectuals, mostly philosophers, actually. And none of them speak one word about religion. And this is why I want to talk about religion today. They only talk about race. And these are, for the most part, nationalist intellectuals. So sovereignist intellectuals, along with some federalist individuals as well, who all share this same nationalism. And intellectuals have been working so hard for about 30 years to create what they call civic nationalism, which is about a common project. Really, you might as well be Pierre Trudeau. But a civic nationalism, as opposed to the ethnic and xenophobic nationalism. And what they're saying is that now, all their work to really make nationalism palatable to those who are not Purlin has been undone by these xenophobic ethnic nationalists. And so you have a huge fight amongst nationalists that doesn't follow the usual nationalist, sovereignist, or nationalist, federalist lines, the nation within Quebec or within Canada or outside of Canada, but the civic nationalists against the ethnic nationalists. And I think that that's a fascinating aspect of this struggle.
Do you want to go any further with that?
I guess I do occasionally lean towards conspiracy theories.
But fun.
And it seems to be that
you're a professor of English literature.
Right. Yeah. I like stories. They don't have to be factual. It seems to be that Marois' timing and the nature of this addition is far from accidental, and it has an awful lot to do with declining interest in the Parti Quebecois, the drop in the popular vote, the disappearance of the Bloc from federal politics. This is a rearguard action. It's to try to rally the troops. It's like the walls built in Arizona to keep out Mexicans. It is very similar to the kinds of gambits that you see in the States by some extreme Republicans to declare that U.S. has only one official language. And there's symbolic attacks on the other, and to rally those who see themselves as being Purlin. And I still can't really divorce it. I mean, we can, what should I say, trick it out in fairly elaborate ideological analysis, and I think there is that, and it is kind of an extension of that, but the timing is too obvious to me to be anything other than a pretty cynical wedge issue has been introduced. And of course, dealing with a prime minister who has made it a cause célèbre to use only wedge issues makes sense.
I didn't want to take that step because I want to limit myself to saying what we can see. The intentions behind it are not entirely opaque. I'll say that.
Boy, you really put yourself on the line.
Oh, yeah.
Not entirely opaque.
Well, as the official Quebecer, I have to be careful about how I think.
Alex?
I think, now I just
want
to follow up on what Harry mentioned is talking about, and notwithstanding the beautiful and nuanced explication and analysis of the Charter, I was afraid that what I was going to offer was more a comment of my own naivete, whatever. I find it very difficult to see this issue in anything as anything other than connected to a larger anxiety that Harry points out about whatever xenophobia or about the other. I mean, again, notwithstanding the things that you're saying, that doesn't even make sense. But when I looked at this document, and as I've been reading the commentary and listening to the stuff on the radio as well, it's hard for me not to see the business of, say, wearing a crucifix and what size it is and where there are. That all seems to be collateral. And what is at issue is Islam, subspecies of interpretations of Islam, all this sort of thing. That seems to me where the anxiety is, and maybe I lack the nuanced view to see it, but I see that driving it, and I'm not sure about radio phone-in shows and the CBC generally. It's necessarily a good barometer, but the Rex Murphy's program a couple weeks ago was about this topic. So a national phone-in show, and I mean, there are people who were radically positioned against it, the principal position against it, but people who were in favor of it, and a lot of people were calling from outside of Quebec, were talking about Islam, and we're talking about Muslims, and we're talking about Muslim women. So I think maybe it's not just me, but it's difficult for people. I mean, it seems to me that's really the issue, and these other things that it then becomes necessary to say, oh, and of course no crucifixes and no other religious symbol. But what was really at stake is veiled women specifically, and more broadly, an outgrowth of this idea of clash of civilizations. A fundamental anxiety. I mean, that's still working in the United States as well. I don't think it's limited, it's exclusive to Quebec either. Do you know what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying.
More broadly, is concerned with Islam and issues of assimilation and cultural.
So I understand what you're saying, but I disagree. It's because it's a larger issue, and because in the States you don't have this. So, if this is the reason, then it should be happening all over the place. So, for me, that explanation can only be part of the issue. Bouchard and Taylor, in the report, have pointed out that Quebecers must do a few things to allow for cultural relations to work well, one of which is to abandon that vision of an inevitable disappearance of the Quebecois people and of their language. It's not inevitable. It will probably not happen. You can be watchful. That's fine. We don't have to be panicked about the French language and the Quebecers disappearing. So, and the second thing is that they have to see how that anxiety as to, I mean, it's an ontological anxiety. Will we keep existing? Will this nation keep existing? They have to see that this anxiety has effects on other people. And has really dangerous and bad effects on those people. And this is where you bring back xenophobia, I think, at that point. It's this anxiety over their own survival, a lot more so than, which leads to this kind of reaction, a lot more so than an overall anxiety towards the presence of many cultures or of Islam specifically.
Just a footnote to that, I mean, one of the ironies is that so many of the immigrants to Quebec from various countries in Africa, of course, speak beautiful French. And Quebec argued long and hard to get the right to control immigration. I think this goes back to that very curious and deep issue, which is not on the table here, but which is always exercises me. What does it really mean when you cut out the religious dimensions of culture and then claim that you need to preserve culture? And then, at least for a generation, think you do that by preserving language. It's very curious.
So I'd like to probably invite us to end on these very wise words, to which I'd like to add, but probably shouldn't. We've promised to be out of this room by 2, and so that people can start at 2. So you can, of course, come and speak to us for the next couple minutes as we get ready to leave or outside here, but to honor our commitment to not stake this as our ground. I believe I speak in David's name as well when I thank you for coming to speak with us today. Hopefully this was useful to you, and we're happy to continue this dialogue over the next while. It's in a month or so that this charter will actually come before Parliament. It'll be in the news again. There'll be more conspiracy theories, more evil plots, more stories to look into at that point. In the meantime, thank you.
Thank you.